Hey guys, welcome to the show.
I think it needs one more little thing on the end there after John Hagee. Am I right? I love that thing though. You guys like that? The guy that made it is going to make a few different more, I think, I hope. And that'll be cool, man. Then we won't have to listen to The Onion all the time. Only some of the time. I used to love The Onion radio things, but I think they stopped being funny. So anyway. Yeah. Hillary Clinton waxing rhetorical about backing Al-Qaeda in Syria. Now that's funny. All right, well, so yeah, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. That's also my website, only it's .org, not .com, because some other guy's got .com, a newspaper man from Oklahoma, actually. Seems like a nice enough guy, only he won't let me have his URL. But other than that, he's great. But I'm ScottHorton.org, even though I'm not really an org, I'm just a me, but that's all right. ScottHorton.org. I keep all of my stuff there, including about 3,700 interviews that I've done since 2003, mostly all on foreign policy, especially since 07. And anyway, so, yeah, that's basically the gig. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. That is opposition to all of it, with a focus on debunking things that aren't true. Today on the show, you could have guessed, our good friends, Gareth Porter, Phil Giraldi, Eric Margolies. Imagine that. Well, the good news is, I'm getting, these three guys out of the way on Monday this week. And then, so the rest of the week, I'll try to maybe get some different people on more and better. And now, but so you guys understand how this gig works. I don't call these people based on who they are. I don't email them based on who they are to talk about them. I invite them based on what they wrote. And Gareth Porter has two very important stories. One of them is about nitty-gritty of the Iran nuclear deal, and the other is about the big picture of the Iran nuclear deal and America's relationship with Iran and the entire insane American foreign policy in the Middle East, etc. Both great. Now, in Phil's case, it's sort of who he is and not what he wrote, but not really, because what he wrote, it was just a little bit of a while back, but he is a real expert on the professional Islamophobia movement in America. And though he's not a libertarian, I think he's got a pretty strong affinity for the Bill of Rights and things like that. So, he'll be here to fight to the death of the, for the right of people he despises to say the horrible things that they say. Something along those lines, I guess. And then, Eric Margolies will be here to talk about the Vietnam War, which, had their big anniversary. Boy, I'm getting old, man. If it's the 40th anniversary, then that means I'm damn near 40 almost. I mean, a couple years away. Still, though, I was like, wait, is that right? I almost said 30th. No, but that wouldn't be right. The 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, the victory of the Reds in Vietnam, and Eric Margolies has a very well-written piece, which, you know, not that most of them aren't or anything. Just, it's a really interesting one about the end of the Vietnam War, what it means to him anyway. And Ray McGovern had another good one, and there's been a few. I'll tell you what, if you want your socks blown off, read Nick Turse's book, Kill Anything That Moves. Man, oh man, is that thing something else. You can listen to my interview with him about it. If you just search my name and Nick Turse's name, T-U-R-S-E, and Vietnam, you'll find the interview there. And, man, oh man, I'll tell you, that is, that's a hell of a thing. You want to watch a good documentary about it, look up American Holocaust on YouTube And if you do that, you'll find some stuff about the Indians too, which I'm not diminishing the importance of that, but I'm just saying, if you're looking for the one about Vietnam, it's in there. And yeah, that's a pretty good one too. But yeah, you read Nick Turse's book and it's just like 300 pages of facepalm. Oh my God. Are you kidding me? What a catastrophe. Yeah. So anyway, that's the show today. Gareth Porter on Iran. Phil Giraldi. Oh, also, he's going to have some things to say about Iran. I got to read his new Iran article during the next commercial break. Or maybe the top of the hour one. Before he comes on. And then also Pamela Geller and all that. And then Eric Margolies on Vietnam. Okay, so now, so straight to the Garland thing. And obviously, this is the subject of the Giraldi interview. If you didn't hear, last night in Garland, Texas, which, geez, I think is right outside of Dallas or Houston. I was going to say Dallas, and then I thought, oh, no, wait a minute, maybe that's near Houston. Both of those cities are gigantic megalopolises with, you know, like Dallas is 20 towns all stuck together. Only one of them is called Dallas, like L.A. You know what I mean. You got Culver City or whatever, but it's really just a neighborhood in Los Angeles, right? Kind of. Anyway. So, geez, now I got to Google it because I sound like a complete idiot. Garland, Texas, and show me on the goddamn map there, man. Oh, yeah, it is up near Dallas, right? Am I right? I'm zooming out. Yeah. It's up there northeast Dallas, up near Plano. See, I thought I knew that. I was right the first time before I went and second-guessed myself. So, anyway, here's the thing. Pamela Geller, who is this despicable professional Islamophobe, spreader of anti-Muslim propaganda and intolerance, she hosted this thing with Geet Wilders, who, if you ever read Antiwar.com very much, you might know about him. He's this Dutch fascist. You know, he's the Dutch Pamela Geller, right? And anyway, so the thing about him is they held this thing where he was the keynote speaker, and then the whole thing was, and I love it as Fox News puts it, an art exhibit. Yes, it was an art exhibit. Everybody draw the most insulting, sarcastic depiction of the Prophet Muhammad that you can in order to see, let's see what kind of reaction we can provoke. And then what happened was, apparently, allegedly, this guy from Arizona that named Simpson, who the FBI has known about for a long time and sort of half-assed prosecuted him before and put him on probation before and whatever, that he's the one who did it. He drove up, he shot a security guard in the ankle, and then the cops completely waxed him and his whoever was with him. There was another guy in the car with him. So that was the extent of the attack, thank goodness for that. There's a police shooting I can get behind. Guy drives up in a car, shoots an unarmed man in the leg, blow him away. You just forfeited your right to keep breathing, dude. Now you're done breathing. Go ahead and shoot him. Doesn't matter if it's a cop or anyone else has the right to kill the two guys in the car who drove up and shot the innocent man. Simple as that. Case closed. No problem. But what a catastrophe. Because this is just a whole other level of propaganda for the Islamophobia industry. And this twisted lie that Islam motivates people to do bad things and to wage war against those who would, you know, dare to be free. And now, it's a complicated mess and the music's playing. I gotta go, but more complaining like this in just a second. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, I don't know why anybody even needs to go through this. I see people on Twitter going, I defend people's right to draw cartoons. Here I am by tweeting that. I am defending their right to draw cartoons without being shot by religious fanatics. Well, how brave. But yeah, I mean, everybody agrees with that except for these two, whatever you call them, in the car that are now dead. But here at the Daily Beast, the headline reads, Muslims defend Pam Geller's right to hate. Both before Pam Geller's Draw Muhammad event and after the attack Sunday night, Muslim American leaders vigorously defended her right to draw whatever she wants. Because, you know, the First Amendment, the first part of it, before free speech and free press, is the prohibition on the government ever attempting to establish an official religion. And then the next clause is protecting the free exercise thereof. And now that's protecting them from the national government. I'm not saying that the First Amendment forbids Pam Geller from drawing cartoons or anything. Obviously, it forbids the government from ever stopping her from doing any such thing. But what this very, very jerky lady doesn't seem to understand, maybe she's never heard of this, that religious freedom is the most, or is equal to, is up there tied for first place with all of the most important freedoms in, really, in human society, but especially in this one. Freedom of religion is what we're all about. And that, of course, necessarily entails and implies tolerance for other people's different beliefs. And, you know, it ought to be easy enough to just, well, anyway, nah, I'll save all that for the draw of the interview. But, so the thing of it is, she has the right to be as jerky as she wants, but do the shoe other foot thing for just a moment. And pretend that this whole thing was about drawing, cartoons of Jesus drowning in piss. And what would all the right-wingers say about that? Or if it was a contest, show us your most cynical depiction of a Jew. Or a conference of the elders of Zion or some crap. Imagine the firestorm that would cause. But, oh, yeah, no, the Muslims, screw them and their beliefs. We can pick on them all we want because there's an important lie going on that their religion makes them attack the United States when everybody who's not a liar or an idiot knows that, no, it's because George H.W. Bush launched a war against Iraq from Saudi Arabia and then stayed there, and then so did Bill Clinton, stayed in Saudi Arabia to continue bombing Iraq and blockading Iraq for another decade after that. And the only thing Islam has to do with it is solidarity. And anyway, you do the shoe other foot thing for just a moment. And think about how outrageous it would be. Now, of course, the point would still be the same, that a bunch of Nazis have a right to draw cartoons of Jews if that's what they want to do, post them on their websites, tweet them out, hold a contest to see who can draw the most insulting one. Because this is America. And what the hell is this? The old world or something? Everybody's got a right to draw whatever stupid cartoon. For other private people to attack and kill them, attempt to kill them, for doing so is completely you know, mad and crazy. But going around picking on people just for their religious beliefs is absolutely despicable, too. It's the same thing. Just as bad, or it's not the same thing. Just as bad. And so, anyway, I don't know, man. And then, after the whole thing's over and the guys are dead, they still, every cop has to dress up in his best Marine Corps outfit. Like, come on, man. In Northeast Dallas, I don't know, Plano's a really nice, you know, upper middle class city, pseudo city there in North Dallas. I don't know about Garland so much. Isn't that where Jeff Phillips is from? But I'm pretty sure that's like a pretty nice part of Dallas there. And even in a terrorist attack like this, they could all be just as easily wearing blouses and slacks and carrying 9mm. What the hell is all the hubbub? Oh, call out the MRAP. Call out the robot. Call out the machine gun force for two guys that are already dead. And by the way, the FBI knew this guy all along. What exactly was their relationship with him? If that's the first headline out of here, is that, yeah, they knew him all along. And if they knew him all along, and if according to the Dallas Morning News this morning, he even tweeted out, Dallas attack, I'm going to be with Allah or whatever crap was he say here. The bro with me and myself have given Baya to Amiral Munmin. I have no idea what that means, who that is or what that is. If that's out of the Quran or if that's some guy in Saudi Arabia right now or what, I have no idea. And then he says, may Allah accept us as Mujahideen, make dua. And I don't know what that means either, although kind of sounds familiar, like I heard it before. But anyway, Texas attack is the hashtag. He was the first one to post that. Anyway, so for all of their heavy duty FBI spying, all of their using the FISA court and the Fourth Amendment like their little bitch, the FBI, the NSA, the entire national security state completely unable to protect us from things like this. Knew about the guy all along. Then he went and did this right under their nose, at best. That's the best interpretation that we got. So maybe, actually, the lesson is, we don't need an FBI at all. Did you ever consider that? That what if we had America only without the FBI? Because who needs them? Because what are they good for? You know, like the guy that did the attack at Fort Hood, who'd been emailing with Anwar al-Awlaki. Hey, you think it'd be okay if I shot some people? Guys, yellow alert. Oh, well. Anyway, so, I don't know. I guess the problem is, of course, like probably even this dead idiot could have figured out, right, that this only helps Pamela Geller and hurts American acceptance of Muslims and helps a bunch of liars and killers with their propaganda campaign to demonize Islam itself as the cause of the corruption of the people who believe in it. What a dick. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Well, I don't know, man. Here on Twitter, Bill Kristol has a thing, four reasons Rand Paul won't win. So maybe I'm wrong, and he actually will. Because if Bill Kristol says something, then the truth is always the opposite, especially a prediction. Nah. That could have been slightly funny if I had delivered it better, but anyway, doesn't matter. I got Gareth Porter on the line. He wrote two very important things that we got to talk about. The first one is at Truth Out, As Israel lobby pushes full access inspections, U.S. makes false claim on Iran nuclear deal. That's very important. And then also why Iran must remain a U.S. enemy. Gareth Porter, he wrote the book on Iran's nuclear program. Of course, it's called Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he wrote about 10 million great articles for ipsnews.net. You can find virtually all of them at antiwar.com/Porter, and he also won awards for his great work at Truth Out on the Afghan surge, and maybe on the Iraq surge too. And now here he is. He often writes for Middle East Eye now, and here he is at Al Jazeera, and again here at Truth Out. Yeah, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. Good to be back again. How are you?
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Very important stuff going on here. So, first of all, just if I can try to sum up very quickly, we have an interim deal ever since November 2013, and the P5 plus one, which is America and the entire United Nations Security Council plus permanent members plus Germany, have been negotiating with Iran on their nuclear deal to scale it back, expand inspections in exchange for sanctions relief. And now we're at the point here in the spring of 2015 where we have a framework for a final deal, and we have a deadline for the end of June to hammer out the last details to finally put this thing to bed here. And it encompasses a lot of important moving parts and this kind of thing. And one of them is the level of inspections under the additional protocol, which Iran has agreed to sign, and just what the IAEA will be able to do in Iran, and how that compares to what the Americans' demands are. So I guess please take it from there if I got that much right.
Well, you do have that much right, and indeed the negotiations now are, you know, in a sense in the final lap around the track.
Oh, did I lose you?
Which involves they couldn't. I'm still here. Can you hear me, Scott?
Yeah, go back to lap around the track. There is where I lost you for a sec.
Yeah, I was just saying that it is the final lap around the track in the sense that there are relatively few issues left, but they are the ones that were the most difficult to resolve. And of course, among them first of all, there's the question of the research and development, which still has some loose ends, very important loose ends to be resolved. And there's the question of exactly and what is the timeline, what is the schedule for lifting sanctions of various kinds against Iran. That's definitely unresolved. And then the third one, which is the one that I talked about in this piece that you've just referred to, is what in fact will Iran be required to agree to allow the IAEA to do? Under what circumstances will the IAEA be able to go to visit various kinds of sites? And that is another very sensitive issue for all kinds of reasons. Politically sensitive in Iran because, of course, they're very concerned about spying by foreigners, by people who are associated with the IAEA, leaking militarily sensitive information to the Israelis and the Americans. and politically sensitive in Washington because the Israelis and their lobby have been pushing very, very hard to get through language which would essentially set the Israelis up to be able to continue the kind of disinformation campaign that they've been so good at over the past several years, and continue to raise flags about alleged nuclear weapons work on military bases specifically. And that's where this issue has come down to a very difficult political situation for the Obama administration, to say the least. Mm.
In other words, the Iranians will never concede that you can just walk around wherever you want at any time, including all their most highly classified facilities. But the Americans won't back off those kind of demands. And so if we have anything less than that, which is what we're going to end up having to settle for, then the Israelis get to continue saying, yeah, but there could be something here and there could be something exactly. there, and just pretending forever it'll be just like they never even had the deal in the first place. Well, the issue won't have been put to bed even with the new expanded inspection regime, et cetera.
That is precisely right. In other words, you're correct. The Iranians will never agree to to language which allows that kind of situation to continue indefinitely. And that is exactly what the Congress has been insisting on. And it's, in fact, it's written into the legislation that they have passed that they expect to have a regime for inspection that essentially allows the IAEA to go wherever it wants, wherever it suspects anything is taking place, so that essentially Iran would be treated as an occupied country, a defeated country, the way Iraq was after the first Gulf War. And, of course, that's not going to happen. Nothing like that is going to happen. And in fact, I will tell you that as my piece, I hope, makes clear, the Obama administration understands this perfectly well, and they have already agreed to move back at least a step from that, the formula that the Israeli lobby is demanding. And that is something much more ambiguous in terms of, what I say in the piece is that I don't think it has been negotiated yet at all, but there's kind of agreement in principle, in a very vague way, that there will be some kind of system that allows, I think they call it enhanced access. The term, I believe, is enhanced access. So in principle, yes, some enhanced access to be agreed upon, to be negotiated, and that hasn't been done yet. I think that means
access to the mines and maybe the centrifuge factory, right, where there's not necessarily nuclear material being introduced, but it's still not marching into Parchin and looking around wherever they want.
Yeah, I think that is roughly correct. But I think there's some nuances here that are being dealt with through this ambiguous language, which is that the United States wants to go beyond simply having visits to centrifuge factories and mines, and they want to try to negotiate something that allows a system whereby if there's enough evidence that they could justify visiting a military base. I think that's what the Americans are after. And there's where the rub's going to come. I mean, the Iranians are going to be very tough in their negotiating stance on that, and I think it's going to be very tough to reach an accommodation on this issue. That will certainly, it's going to be impossible to satisfy the Israeli lobby, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But whether they can arrive at a formula that is general enough to be acceptable to both sides and still meaningful is a big question mark. But what my story does here is to show that the Obama administration was clearly overselling what they got in the negotiations in Lausanne, completely overselling.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with more Gareth Porter right after this.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Oscar Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, talking with Gareth Porter from Middle East Eye, Truth Out, Al Jazeera. And he, of course, wrote the book Manufactured Crisis about the Iran nuclear program. And now, so did you see this Bloomberg thing, Gareth, where Yukiya Amano, the head of the IAEA, said clarifying the possible military dimensions is essential. It's important to restore confidence, even if it has never been a precondition for reaching an agreement. Sounds like maybe he's backpedaling a little bit there, and they're going to let this be, you know, work itself out and take a more easygoing attitude toward the... Because after all, the possible military dimensions is quite a mess of accusations. It's going to take them a while to go through, so they can't... You know, they're obviously going to have to take their time trying to resolve them to whatever degree they can, right?
Well, that's an issue that, as you know, I've been very interested in and followed very closely, as closely as I can. And I can tell you that there is a continuing linkage between the possible military dimensions, the resolution of that issue with the IAEA on one hand, and not the reaching of an agreement, but, of course, the implementation of the agreement, including the lifting of sanctions. And in other words, there's a specific set of UN sanctions that there apparently is an agreement in principle that there will be some kind of linkage between the PMD resolution and the lifting of those sanctions. Everything that's agreed to depends on agreement on everything else. And so that's tentative. But my understanding is that is what is supposed to be finalized in the final round of negotiations or final rounds of negotiation. And so I'm not ready to say that Amano is going to relax now and say, don't worry about it. We got your back covered here. No. I think he's still part of the U.S.-European alliance against Iran. He is taking his orders from the White House. He is going to utilize the negotiations with or the talks with Iran he's going to use the necessity for the Iranians to satisfy him in order to get the lifting of that set of sanctions that I referred to, in order to force the Iranians to basically do whatever he wants them to. And the question that remains is, you know, is he going to admit that he doesn't really have any evidence to support the idea that there was covert nuclear weapons work by Iran? Or is he too committed to that position? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, in other words, too committed to the idea that he is,
maybe they'd be able to go ahead and back away from it by just kind of going through and giving them a clean bill of health on each issue kind of one at a time. And that's sort of what happened with the telegrams, right? All the receipts for the dual use stuff is they never really said, whoa, we were totally wrong about that. But they did admit that each and every issue had been resolved. So let's move
on. Well, that, of course, was Alberadi.
That was his
decision.
Yeah.
Had it been up to Ali Heinonen, that wouldn't have happened.
Right.
Because Heinonen was already, you know, working hand in glove with the Bush administration. in 2008 when that decision, mm-hmm. in 2007, 2008 decision. So it really was, that revealed Baradei's much greater even-handedness on this issue. And Amano is exactly the opposite. I mean, you know, I'm now finishing a piece that quotes Amano at a meeting of the so-called like-minded group of states, meaning basically the English language countries plus Japan. And in this meeting in early 2008, he was saying, oh, yeah, Baradei, he'll probably say that the Iranians have confessed to being not guilty.
Man, your audio is kind of cutting out on us a little bit. That's why your punchline fell flat. Hey, if maybe you're...
Camp of the Bush administration.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, Gareth, your audio is going kaput on us here. Can you hear me?
Am I talking too fast?
No. It's your wireless connection, maybe?
Oh, okay.
Are you plugged in or are you wireless?
I'm wireless.
All right. Well, are you near your router?
Yes.
Well, that's good.
Let me see if I do something about it here. Let me hold on.
There's been a little bit of a problem the whole time, but just now it kind of all went to hell.
I can't seem to find the plug-in here. Where is it?
All right. Well, anyway, talking with Gareth Porter about his piece here at Truth Out, as Israel lobby pushes full access inspections, U.S. makes false claims on the Iran nuclear deal, and so that was what we're talking about. And I forget if we talked about the part where they kind of got out ahead of what they claimed the Iranians had agreed to in the talking points that they had released on the framework there. Is that right,
Gary? Well, yeah, that's basically the punchline of my story here, although, you know, in a sense, it's the beginning point. The punchline is what President Obama revealed in his interview with Tom Friedman. But right immediately after the negotiations in Lausanne were completed, Kerry's publicly saying, the Iranians have agreed, we have an agreement to basically be able to go wherever we suspect a site. That was the way it was sold by Kerry, by Ben Rhodes, and ultimately by Obama himself in that interview with Friedman. He crowed that, we're setting up a system whereby we can go wherever we suspect something. And then further on in the interview, he basically acknowledged that, well, it's a lot more complicated than that. They're setting up a system whereby, you know, well, we can request it, and then the Iranians can say no, and then there will be something will happen whereby the request will be vetted, reviewed for, you know, what the evidence is. And then we don't know exactly how something's going to be decided because he wouldn't say, and I think it's fair to assume that that's because it hasn't been negotiated yet. And so that's really where the situation has finally ended up in the negotiations.
These damn Democrats, they better not screw this thing up. I mean, they already are. They're getting it done, but they're screwing it up at the same time. They're building in all their own obstacles that they don't need for their own policy. It's ridiculous.
Well, I of course agree with you, but I think we have to recognize that this is merely a symptom of the underlying disease, which is that this whole political system has been taken over by, you know, not just the Israeli lobby on one hand, but, you know, powerful business interests and bureaucratic interests who basically control the votes on, you know, the most important issues that they have to vote on.
Yeah, now that's this other article here at AlJazeera.com today, Why Iran Must Remain a U.S. Enemy. And, you know, I'm pretty sure you probably saw it, America.AlJazeera.com, Mark Perry's piece about how the military was concerned about flying as Al-Qaeda's air force in Yemen.
Yes, yes.
And but one of the things that came up in my interview with him last week or 2 weeks ago, yeah, last week, no, 2 weeks ago, was that... about how, you know, when it comes to Iran, that the military definitely does not want to have a war with Iran, and that, and then I asked him, you know, what about all the permanent interests in the national security state, the Pentagon, the CIA, are they willing to go along with the president's push to move toward more normal relations here? And he said, well, at least as far as the military is concerned, they definitely don't want war. And he said there are a lot of arms contractors who are licking their chops at the opening up of a new market and selling the possibility of selling Iran a bunch of weapons now. And so we were joking that that's what you got to do, is you got to get the arms dealers and the military industrial complex behind the peace deal, so that they have their own interests at stake, not in selling weapons to us in the name of that enemy, but going ahead and selling weapons to that enemy so that we can have peace.
That's a brilliant analysis. I subscribe to it entirely. The problem, of course, is getting there is extremely difficult. And, you know, until you get there, then exactly the opposite principle applies. And that's what I talk about in my article, which is that it's precisely the need of the Pentagon to have a justification for both missile defense programs, which are the single, you know, most lucrative research and development program that the Pentagon has had for the last decade and more, and at the same time, the selling of massive amounts of defensive and offensive weaponry to the Saudis and other Gulf sheikhdoms, and particularly the Saudis, of course, they're the dominant source of profit here for anti-missile technology and offensive weaponry. So, you know, the Pentagon at this point is totally committed to the idea that Iran is a threat. They simply cannot back away from that officially. I mean, they can't go around and say, you know, we think that Iran now is a responsible state that we can do business with, and at the same time justify those programs. So, you know, that means that that's not going to happen. I mean, they're simply not going to embrace a normal relationship, let alone a quasi partnership alliance with Iran for many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, Virginia. This is how American foreign policy is made. How much money does Lockheed stand to profit this way or that? That's what it all comes down to.
And I think I made the point in the article that at this moment, these major arms manufacturers, the Lockheeds and Boeings of the United States, are depending on these sales to the Saudis and their Gulf allies for roughly 25% or even more of their profits. That is the reality that we are up against in terms of trying to bring about, or hoping for, let's put it that way, a change in U.S. Policy in the Middle East.
Mm. All right, one last thing here real quick. Our friend Mohammed Sahimi has a piece at the Huffington Post, and honestly, I hadn't even read it yet, but the headline is along the lines, anyway, that the whole, or at least a major part of the Saudi war in Yemen in the name of Iranian support for the Houthis is really just to try to undermine the nuclear deal and all these negotiations and their projected fear that America and Iran are cozying up back to the 70s and that they're going to lose their importance and all that kind of thing. And so by creating this crisis and blaming it all on Iran and making it a Sunni-Shia split where we're stuck on the Sunni side, that'll help undermine the nuclear deal. What do you think of that? Think that's even why they launched the war?
I think that makes sense. I would simply add that, you know, in addition to, and perhaps even more importantly than the hope that this might have some effect on the U.S. negotiating posture, I think even more important than that is the Saudi extremely exaggerated view of the threat that comes from Iran, that there's an Iranian threat to the Saudis that they must do something to disrupt. And this, of course, is the result of this very narrow Wahhabi Wahhabism that the Saudis embrace and that they have been pushing extremely aggressively for decades around the world. And that leads to, shall we say, a slight distortion of perception in the reality about what's been happening in the Middle East. And so I would put the emphasis, you know, substantially differently. I would say that it's much more a response to an exaggerated perception of threat, with perhaps a slight hope that this might help derail the talks. But I don't think they really have that much hope in that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. I kept you over time. I'll let you go now. I appreciate it, Gareth.
Thanks. Sorry for the audio difficulties. Next time, maybe we go back to the old-fashioned phone.
Yeah, you know, we're going to maybe have to go through your settings someday or something. Something's wrong there, but we can work it out. But anyway, it was a great interview anyway, so thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. He wrote the book Manufactured Crisis. You should buy it and read it. And buy two and give one to your library. And also, he writes at aljazeera.com why Iran must remain a U.S. enemy. And then also, as Israel lobby pushes full access inspections, U.S. makes false claims on Iran nuclear deal. That one is at Truthout. You can also find him at Middle East Eye. And we'll be right back with Phil Giraldi in a sec. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer, and he is the executive editor of the Council for the National Interest, and he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and for UNS.com, UNZ, UNS.com, and he sounds like Darth Vader today. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Vader? Thank you, Scott.
You got your dark helmet on today, or what?
No, actually, it's kind of sunny and warm here today, which is a big change. We were
you
in
sound
winter.
Like Rick Moranis and Spaceballs.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a bad day.
All right, well, that's good. All right, hey, listen. So, welcome to the show. You and the Council for the National Interest. You've done some work in the past on this professional Islamophobia movement, and. And, you know, I know you're a Bill of Rights kind of guy, too, so I wonder what all interesting things that you have to say about the shooting here in Garland, Texas last night at the Pamela Geller event. Apparently it was a young convert to Islam, a lone wolf and his roommate. Is that how that works? Long known to the FBI, radical extremist attack. He wounded a security guard in the ankle, and then the cops standing there on the beat shot him both to death and finish that crisis off quick, so that's good at least. But what do you make of all of this?
Well, as you noted, I'm a civil liberties guy. I believe that free speech is free speech, and if it offends, it's too bad. I think that if you're calling on someone to kill someone else, that's going over the line. But the what the game that Geller plays is that she's essentially right on that line. She's provoking Muslims to do something by herself staging events that are completely offensive. Like this event in Texas was Muhammad cartoons type event to see who could draw the most offensive cartoon of Muhammad. She recently had posters on buses in New York City saying in big letters, "Kill Jews." Then when you read the poster, of course, it's Muslims who are killing Jews. And so she's really big into this. She's well-funded. I would like to see there more exposure of her in the mainstream media to discredit her and what she does, because she's a real monster.
Well, and boy, did she succeed in provoking this, I mean, which is obviously the whole point. Let's see how extreme we can be in what, how extreme of a reaction we can provoke. And then there you go. Got somebody shot.
Yeah, and apparently there was intensive security laid on by Geller and her people, you know, that had gotten the local police force active, and there were security guards there who were armed. I mean, to a certain extent, the expectation was that somebody would try to do something, and you know, that's totally wrong. It's but it's not illegal, and as I say, people should have the right to say what they want to say, but you know, people have to look at the public has to look at people like Geller and start discrediting them. And I like to see some politicians speaking out on the issue of what she represents. But of course, our gutless politicians aren't about to do that, are they?
Oh, no, they're not. Certainly not. Sorry, my mic was off. Hey, yeah, and you know, the thing of it is, too, that I have a problem, a real problem, and I wonder whether you think that this will ever change with this policy that says that if some young kook decides he wants to go and take the side of the enemy and go fight in Somalia, that he be allowed to go and get himself killed in Somalia instead of keeping him around here where he can end up killing some Americans.
You know, I've wondered about that, too. It's to me, it's a civil liberties issue. If a guy wants to go to Somalia and enlist in whatever the hell is, group is catching his fancy at the time, Al-Shabaab or whatever, well, why not? Let him do it. I mean, if you want to sanction that kind of activity, you have to pass laws on it saying that, you know, for various reasons, because this is a terrorist group, therefore, you know, you have broken the law, and when you come back, we're going to arrest you and prosecute you. Okay, but let's play that angle. But I agree with you. I mean, you know, if any of us wanted to go and join one of these groups, I would think that in to a certain extent, to a certain level, we have kind of the right to do it.
Yeah, well, and it seems like, just pragmatically speaking, too, you had the same thing in Canada where this guy wanted to go and fight in Syria. They wouldn't let him go, so he attacked the parliament. You know?
Yeah.
If they really want to commit treason, let him go do it somewhere else and not go, you know, stage an attack on behalf of the Islamic State in our neighborhoods. What the hell?
Yeah, well, this is always the problem with this whole war on terrorism bit. There are a lot of pieces to it that don't make any sense.
Yeah,
essentially, like for example, there was a good article I read this morning. You and I have talked about this before, how our policy in Yemen is to support the people who are actually fighting the people who attacked us on 9/11.
Right.
So it doesn't make any sense. And this is another thing, too. If you have people living in the United States who are so disgruntled and hate us so much that they want to go off and join a terrorist group and kill people, well, let them go.
Right. And by the way, the thing I just said about in the name of the Islamic State, I just made that up as we were joking around. I didn't mean to say that I read somewhere that these guys said they did this for the Islamic State or anything. I should clarify that. I was just kind of...
Yeah, the only connection appears to be Somalia, and I'm not so sure what your real evidence is for that. But
yeah,
we're getting a lot of early stuff now where people are just guessing.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as they claim, he wanted to go there. That doesn't mean anything, really. It doesn't mean that they're on his side, just that he's on theirs, allegedly, attemptedly, you know, however you say
Yeah,
that.
Well, maybe he wanted to volunteer for the CIA station there or something. You know, yeah. I mean, who knows?
Go work at the torture prison.
Right.
Pay well with our tax money over there. All right,
yeah.
So now, and here's the thing, too, is all of this is just an alibi for this is all George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama's fault that we have this problem. It's not Islam. It's the occupation and the mass slaughter and the support for the Israelis and all the arms sales that Gareth Porter was just talking about in the last interview and all the rest of this. That's why we have a terrorism problem. You know, it was America that destroyed Somalia. They were actually doing all right without a government before we came and foisted one on them.
Yeah, I mean, it was a free market economy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was doing, it was, hey, for Somalia, it was paradise, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, it's, you know, there's no question but that the United States has screwed all this stuff up. There was an idiotic piece over at the American Conservative today by Jim Antle about how, you know, the U.S. and ISIS and all this kind of stuff and everything was, basically like came out of nowhere. But you know, this is the whole terrorism problem and everything developed because we intervened and created a huge vacuum in the middle of, you know, of the Arab world. And this kind of stuff, there's always a cause and effect. And for some reason, our politicians and the experts in Washington can't quite ever figure it out.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, too, to see Rand Paul. I mean, he throws his father's views under the bus on virtually everything. But to go as far as throw him under the bus on the whole blowback issue, when that was the thing that made Ron Paul a hero, was that he was brave enough, the only Washington, D.C. politician, brave enough to just go ahead and tell the simple truth to the American people. This problem precedes September 11th. That's why September 11th happened, because we were already over there bombing Iraq from Saudi for years and years. And you all remember that, the 1990s, the bridge to the 21st century. And the people said, yeah, we do remember that. It was all Bill Clinton's fault. And so maybe we don't have to have a permanent war over there. If having a war over there is what got us into this mess in the first place, maybe we could just quit. That was the thing that gave Ron Paul the most mileage of all, was fighting and winning over Rudy Giuliani on that. And now Rand is saying, no, the problem is radicalism. Right in the middle, yeah, when there's a giant sectarian war between Tehran and Riyadh, Shia and Sunni across the Middle East, is right when he wants to lump them all together even more than before and run away from the great truth that was the best thing his dad had going for him campaign-wise. And anyway, now I rambled all the way up to the break, which is probably better than asking a question that you won't have time to answer, Phil, so be
That's
happy
right.
about that. Hang tight. We'll be right back, everybody, with Phil Giraldi on the Islamophobes and them. After this. Oh, and Iran, too. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me, too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, former CIA counterterrorism officer, writer for the American Conservative magazine and UNS.com, the UNS Review. That's UNZ, UNS.com. And you guys even did a big conference about Islamophobia, and you've got quite a bit of material on the website at councilforthenationalinterest.org about that, too. And now the bottom line of this, let me go ahead and name Max Blumenthal did a great piece called The Great Fear that he wrote for Tom Dispatch that's also at antiwar.com. It was back in 2010, but still that wasn't that long ago, and it's a great piece. And then at the Center for American Progress, Eli Clifton, I believe he was involved in both of these quite a few years apart here. And now all of a sudden the title escaped me, but there's two of them at the Center for American Progress about the Islamophobia industry. Maybe it's just Islamophobia Inc. or something like that. Anyway, part one and two, and you can find it there at cap.org, I guess it is. And Eli Clifton is a great journalist, and he's got a great study of this. And I think the bottom line, if I can sift it all, Phil, is that the Islamophobia movement is really just about demonizing enemies and would-be enemies of Israel in the minds of Americans from now on. That's really what all this is about. What do you think?
Oh, don't forget
I hit
that.
The wrong damn button, Phil. I'm sorry. I'm used to everybody being on Skype. Say again.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, okay. No, I would point out it's a European thing, too. It's an attempt to really... create a perception of Muslims in general, which is extremely negative. And of course, the real reason behind this is not necessarily because they are Muslim. It's because they are perceived as being intrinsically hostile to Israel. And therefore, you have people like Pamela Geller, who are closely tied to Israel and get their money from extremely Israel-friendly sources, who are running this kind of thing. I mean, she's not the only one. There are quite a few of them out there, as I'm sure you're aware. And quite a few of them in Europe. And the whole idea is, if Israel can be seen as a beacon of liberality, then you get there by blackening all of Israel's perceived enemies, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to me. I think it's in it's in Clifton's work, and I forget if you guys covered this part of it, but. The push to get, they have model legislation to get through in all the 50 states to protect against encroaching Sharia law takeover. And In no case is there actually a threat of Sharia law takeover of anything. But it comes with that giant built-in kind of silent premise there that, well, obviously they must be trying to roll back something if they're introducing a law to limit Sharia. And Sharia must have picked the fight, but it didn't. But it doesn't matter because it just helps to, reinforce that overall kind of idea that, no, yeah, Islam, the bin Ladenism is a threat in your county, you know, unless you do something about it now, unless you be afraid and back who we tell you to back.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously an effort to portray Islam as primitive and dangerous, and that's one of these generalizations that just doesn't wash. I mean, anybody who's known, I think, large numbers of Muslims or even reasonably large numbers would I think agree with me that there are all kinds of Muslims, and this kind of painting them all by the same brush is wrong and it's evil, and yet that's what they're doing and they're getting away with it.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems strange, especially in America where, you know, I don't know the exact breakdown. I only know kind of anecdotally, but it sure seems like the vast majority of Muslims in America are upper middle class. They're the people who could afford to leave their home countries and come here for grad school and be engineers and owners. They're, you know, would vote Republican if the Republicans probably didn't hate them so damn much. And they're as integrated into American society as you could hope for them to be as far as all that melting pot stuff goes. So it sort of seems like, you know, they're tilting at a caricature of the French Muslim ghettos that don't really resemble any situation that exists in North America.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing, and you're quite right about the status of Muslims in the United States. They're above average in income, they're above average in education, and they're way below average in terms of committing crimes.
Which, in other words, they have every interest in keeping the peace and living their lives and raising their children in insecurity like everybody wants, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It seems... if nobody put this guy up to it, they might as well have, because, you know, he's just served this now dead guy, has just served Pamela Geller's purpose better than anybody could have by attacking her in this way. And by her, I mean Robert Spencer and the whole rest of this mm-hmm. movement, too, you know?
Right. Well, maybe he was put up to it.
It certainly
Don't
could
rule
be.
That
I
out.
Mean,
Don't rule that out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen so many of these where the FBI puts a guy up to it through an informant and then swoop in to save the day. It seems, mm-hmm. you know, if this wasn't the time, it seems pretty likely that at some point we're going to have one where they go ahead and do the thing and the FBI is unable to stop them because their alarm doesn't go off in the morning or whatever it is, whatever the screw up is, you know?
That's right.
And they figure out that they're being put on, but they go ahead convinced anyway and do the thing. All right, now, I'm sorry, man. We went on too long about that. I wanted to change the subject to your new article about the Senator Cardin and the Iran legislation. We can go a little bit into the break, too, which would be fine for the people listening to the recording later anyway. So can you tell us about the conventional narrative of the status of these the Cardin deal on the new Iran legislation going through versus how you see them here?
Well, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that this is a watered-down bill, the Corker bill as modified by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, that basically it is something that takes the sharp edges off the Republican bill and gathers more support from Congress. And this is seen as a good thing because it's more moderate in some ways. And President Obama has vowed that if it's not changed, he's not going to veto it. So anyway, that's what we kind of have, and everybody's saying, well, that's a relief. The Republican crazies have not taken over this bill and so on and so forth. But I think what they're forgetting about here, there are a couple of agendas playing out. And one of the agendas by AIPAC, incidentally, supports this bill and doesn't want any changes, which is uncharacteristic because normally they would want some really nasty stuff in there to really get the Iranians and derail the negotiations. So they're not supporting that kind of extremism. And I think the point is people are forgetting that AIPAC and the Israel lobby in general, plus a lot of congressmen, have been moaning about the fact that bipartisanship in support of Israel on everything Israel is doing has disappeared as a result of the Netanyahu visit and the response of the Republicans. So one of the big agendas of this bill is to get the Democrats back on board with Israel, which it has done. I mean, a lot of the Democratic senators and congressmen are supporting this bill. It's creating a consensus. So I think the intention of this bill is actually to get a bipartisan approval of this bill, which eventually will lead to voting against the negotiations with Iran. That's the desired result. So we have kind of a Ben Cardin leading this effort to liberalize the process, to bring more Democrats in. But the real intention is to defeat the negotiations that the White House is conducting. Mm-hmm. So I spell all this out in this article that's coming out tomorrow on UNS. And I think that this whole situation is, believe it or not, is more dangerous than if it had been a Republican crazy bill, because everybody would have seen it for exactly what it was.
Yeah. It's too bad that the few Democrats who are actually committed to backing the deal didn't go ahead and help vote for the Rubio Amendment and the Cotton Amendment and all that to try to sabotage the damn thing. I never understood why those idiots were doing that. Are they really that stupid that they were trying to sink the deal, which was as good as they could get it without it getting vetoed?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously every congressman is probably driven by whatever kind of information he's being given by AIPAC or whoever else is feeding him the info sheets. And some of them certainly are cautious because they want to support the president. But the fact is, you know, there are a couple of games being played here. And I think that even the people that want this more moderate, allegedly more moderate bill to pass, they want it to pass because they want more votes. They want more Democrats who are sitting on the fence to join them. And eventually they want to torpedo the negotiations. That's what they want.
Yeah. All right. Now, you know, I wouldn't want to underestimate their power because that wouldn't make sense. But on the other hand, if they really have the deal in hand, then isn't the don't all the political winds really shift toward the president at that point? Wouldn't it be, you know, highly controversial for the Senate to shoot him down at that point?
Well, I mean, that's been the argument for either form of the bill, that basically the president, if he can pull off a deal with Iran, will have all the momentum going with him. And I think that's true. I think that the chances of this succeeding, meaning that we would have a deal with Iran, is significant if the president can pull it off, because I think there'll be a lot of people who maybe privately will be relieved by it, by not having to go into another war. But at the same time, you know, we're looking at a solid Republican majority in both houses, which is dedicated to destroying these negotiations.
Yeah.
And if they get a certain number of Democrats on board, they can do that. So I'm just saying there are a number of games being played here, and it can go in a number of different directions. I honestly, as you know, would love to see Netanyahu, Obama succeed on this, and I'd love to see him, you know, pull this off and have it, you know, as U.S. policy. So we'll see that. But there certainly are powerful forces, including AIPAC, including Congress, that would like to see this fail.
Yep. All right. That's it. We got to go. Thanks so much for coming back on the show, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. All right. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's Phil Giraldi. He's at councilforthenationalinterest.org, the Council for the National Interest, and UNS.com, as well as theamericanconservative.com. And, geez, are we already all the way through the break here? Let's see. And we'll be right back with Eric Margulies in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Just barely made that in the nickel of the dime there. Finishing up with Phil Giraldi. Boy, I've been blowing every break lately. Well, actually, I've been making the middle break, but then blowing the end break on virtually every single interview. I just can't bear to interrupt these great guests and all the great stuff that they say. Also, I'm just really bad at timing. Anyway, we move on now to our friend Eric Margulies. And his great article, The Ghosts of Vietnam Should Haunt Us, But Don't. Eric, as you know, is the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And if there was a conflict any time in, say, I don't know, past 40 years or something, he was there and knows all about it. And so that's why I have him on all the time to explain, because he knows better than pretty much everybody. And right now it's the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the end of a major part of Vietnam. I guess I still bombed them for a few years after that, but mostly that's considered the the end of the Vietnam War at that point. And so now it's the anniversary. So Eric has this piece, The Ghosts of Vietnam Should Haunt Us, But They Don't. Welcome back. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm fine, Scott. Glad to be with you.
All right. So what do you know about this Vietnam thing?
Well, Scott, I know that I enlisted in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. It was 1967. I was a mere youth, and I felt it was the duty of every American citizen, as in the old Roman Republican style, to do his military service when his country was at war. It was a great theory. I enlisted. I was proud to wear my country's uniform. By the way, I still fit into it the other day. I was trying it out. And off I went in the Vietnam War scenario, but I quickly, like many Americans, became disillusioned.
All right. And so what was your role in the war then?
My role was very, very minor. I was originally, well, it's a long story. I won't go into it now, but I was heading for Vietnam as a pioneer of the combat engineers. This was a unit that had a 50% casualty rate. You'd rappel down off helicopters and into create landing zones and kill all the enemy, clear all the mines, let the infantry come in. Well, my military status was abruptly changed 6 days before I was shipping out of Fort Leonard Wood. And I was reassigned to a army base in Massachusetts, where I spent the rest of the war doing some intelligence work, giving command briefings at the Pentagon, and teaching military history and strategy, believe it or not, to field grade officers, that is, a colonels and above.
Huh. So you had Bill Clinton hook you up with that, or what? How did that work?
No, I did it all on my own. You know, I could have stayed out of the military because I had been offered to do a PhD in history at Cambridge, and that would have given me a deferment. But I didn't, and you know,
I'm
I really
just joshing with you. I honor draft dodgers, man. Screw that.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed my first year in the Army, but I felt the second one was a tremendous waste. But more important than that, my role was tiny. But I am sorry to this day that I didn't go to Vietnam. And I look back on the thing as what a big mess and waste of life and money. But we keep seeing these recurring, hence the title of my column, The Ghosts of Vietnam Should Haunt Us, But Don't.
Yeah, but why should you regret not going? You wish you'd been in the position where you would have had to kill those people resisting invasion of their land? I don't get it.
Quite right, Scott. Well, it's a mixed feeling because I'm sorry to have missed this historical event. As someone who writes a great deal on military affairs, I've covered 14 wars as a war correspondent, so I've been under fire many times since. But half of me regrets it, half of me doesn't, because you never know what could have happened to you.
Yeah. Well, I guess it would have been fine if they sent you as a reporter, but that would have been a different thing.
Well, I would have probably ended up in some administrative position. It's funny, when I was in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, I was immediately made the company clerk because I was the only soldier there, only enlisted soldier, who could read and write. It was horrifying for me from New York City. I didn't know there were people in my country who couldn't read. But there they were, and there they were in the Army.
Yeah. Well, all right. So anyway, let's talk about this thing here. Because so World War II ended, and the French had, quote-unquote, owned Indochina, as they called it. And then they got beat by the people who lived there and were forced out. And then, so why then did the Eisenhower, or I guess even the Truman and then Eisenhower administrations, take the side of the French? And why do they continue the fight instead of just recognizing? I think I even remember reading that Ho Chi Minh had declared independence and had cribbed all the language from Thomas Jefferson, was really trying to suck up to the Americans. We can do business, you know, kind of a thing, but they just wouldn't have it. Why not?
I think that I wasn't privy to the thinking at the time, but I think that the Americans first wanted to retain France as a close ally in Europe. And secondly, because there was the feeling throughout the government that the whole Viet Minh run by Ho Chi Minh was really a fronting for the Red Chinese. And there is no doubt that Communist China was deeply involved in supporting the Vietnamese nationalists slash communists. We misinterpreted it. It was a big mistake. We should have supported Ho Chi Minh from the beginning. However, that was the era that anybody who wasn't with us was against us. And, you know, everybody was a communist. We have the same thing today where everybody, is an Islamic terrorist. Just change the labels on it. You get the same idea.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so, but the CIA decided that the domino theory was bogus by 1961, 3 years before the big escalation. So was it really that, or was it more cynical than that?
I think people believed the domino theory right till the end of the war, and it was certainly in Congress and in part of the media, certainly right-wing circles in the U.S. military believed in it, and once again, it was, our troops are in Vietnam. We can't allow them to be defeated by some third world raggedy guerrillas. Same thing we hear in Afghanistan today. We can't bear the humiliation of this happening. So, as I said, the song remains the same.
All right. Now, so, I don't know how much time we really have to get into this, but, I had heard this all along, I guess, at different times, but it took until I read Nick Turse's book, Kill Anything That Moves, before I really, my understanding shifted to America protecting anything independent about the South from the North at all, to simply America invaded Vietnam, and they conquered the South, and they installed a puppet government in the name of having somebody to ask us to stay, basically. And then The war was against the peasant population of the country for daring to resist us, and that was the war. They knew they couldn't invade North Vietnam and conquer it without risking escalation into a full-scale war with China or Russia or something like that. So they had to settle for the Korean model, and then, but the people of the South were never on the side of the puppet government. It had less popular support than Karzai ever had in Kabul, kind of a thing. And the whole thing was just an American war against the civilian population of South Vietnam. Do you see it any different than that?
Oh, I do. I don't subscribe to that view, Scott. It's overly simplistic. What we Americans were fighting against, or the American military was fighting against, were very well-trained, very tough Viet Cong guerrillas, who had originally had Red Chinese advisors, and against the units of the North Vietnamese Army, which was battle-hardened, which had defeated the French, like 324th B Division, and they were armed with heavy weapons, heavy artillery, tanks in some cases. So this wasn't a simple guerrilla struggle against the Vietnamese people. We had a very, very hard, tough opponent in the Vietnamese communist movements. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, the Viet Cong just means South Vietnamese fighting age males, right?
Well, that had enlisted or been enrolled in the movement, yes. And they were fighting both the puppet South Vietnamese government and the Americans who got drawn in because their puppet government was collapsing all the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of my point there, is that there is no real natural power holding up the puppet government in Saigon. It was held up first by the French and then by us, but without us, it would have collapsed in an instant, right?
Yes. Well, maybe a little bit longer, but it would have collapsed, as it eventually did.
But was that just because of the force of the North Vietnamese communists, or because they really had no support among the people of the South? They didn't want to support the Saigon government to keep them independent from North Vietnam. They preferred the government of North Vietnam, right?
The government you don't know is always the better one. I think that's true, Scott. The South Vietnamese government had no loyalty except among South Vietnamese Catholics, who rallied to the government and stood with it right to the very end. Mm-hmm. So the majority of South Vietnamese just wanted to be left alone and duck and get the hell out of the way in this awful war.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I read about these Harvard geniuses up there in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and their strategic Hamlet policy, it sounds like Stalin's 5-year plan. We'll round up everybody from their, steal them all away from their farms and put them in barbed wire concentration camps and call it a collective farm. And then we'll give our sock puppets, wheelbarrows full of money to pass out among the people that we kidnap and round up and put in these prison camps. But, of course, they never get it. Our local sock puppets keep it all, and it wouldn't have worked anyway. And, I mean, what kind of madness is this? How in the hell is that winning hearts and minds when the theory is that as long as these people own a farm and can stay on it, then they're going to be the communist enemy against us? I mean, that goes against the entire, you know what I mean? Like, they own property. We have to separate them from their property so that they won't become communists. And then we'll put them on Stalinite collective farms in order to keep them in the freedom camp.
Well, it sure didn't work, Scott. This notion of segregating the people from the insurgents was actually built by the Italian fascists in the 1930s and 1920s and 30s in Libya, and where the Libyans were rounded up. The British used the same policy during the Boer War in South Africa in the 1880s. So it's not a new concept, but it's a wrong concept because it didn't work. And strategic hamlets were a big fiasco. And the American attempt to kill all the communists that they could find, that Phoenix program, also did not work. And as you rightly point out, Scott, this was done by pointy-headed intellectuals led by the odious Robert McNamara, the most disastrous official in modern American history, who were whiz kids who thought they knew better than anybody, and implemented these policies from their ivory towers in Washington.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you do know, I don't know that much, but it sort of seems like the one of the threads all along here from the Pentagon Papers and from the audio tapes of Lyndon Johnson on the telephone and this kind of thing was that they knew they couldn't win all along, but, well, let it be somebody else's problem. Like George W. Bush said about Iraq, let some other presidents figure that out because I'll be retired by then, kind of a thing. And they just went on and you know, we look at 5,000 dead in Iraq on our side. I mean, that's a lot, but 58,000 dead on America's side in what they knew was a no-win war. Was it really that blatant for that long?
It was, unfortunately, and very few people dared to admit that the war was lost, even though a lot of people would say it to their dogs when they got home or their wives. But we see this problem again and again because politicians cannot accept the onus of defeat. No American politician wants to accept that the Afghan war was lost or has been lost. The congressmen and senators who voted for this foolish, stupid, mistaken war can't admit that they sent all these American soldiers to their deaths and wasted, you know, I don't know, up to $2 trillion in the process. So they're hoping that something will happen and they'll blame somebody else. But it is the most important factor, in my view, in perpetuating these lost wars is the fact that nobody wants the blame.
Yeah. You know, I remember being pretty shocked and I was not raised as any kind of right-wing nationalist or anything, but I remember being pretty shocked when I was, a teenager probably, when I first heard Martin Luther King call the U.S. government the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. And really, I think he probably could have said Mao's China. But still, I mean, second place to Mao is not a very good, like, pat on the back, you know, kind of a thing. And, you know, I just never heard anybody say it like that. And then it's Saint MLK that nobody can ever say a bad thing about him, kind of a thing, who's the one saying it at the time. And I think it's really hard for, and I'm talking about when I was a kid, but I think when I was a kid goes for the average American. Now, it's really, really difficult for people to get behind the idea that their side was in the wrong. Even if the leaders of their side are caught on tape saying, boy, we can never win this thing, but let's keep going anyway.
Scott, I agree entirely with you. Even when I was in the military, I could never accept the fact that the U.S. was wrong in this war. I mean, the feeling came over me slowly, but I never saw the U.S. as really as a bad guy or a despoiler of nations. I was always a good American, and my country couldn't do anything terribly bad, but it was doing a lot of things wrong at the time. Still, I supported it, but I remember I was in the mid-1980s. I was in Afghanistan or Pakistan, and I met with Sheikh Abdullah Azam, who was the teacher of bin Laden, was bin Laden's mentor. And the sheikh said to me something that shocked me. He said, after we have defeated Soviet colonialism in Afghanistan, we're going to go and liberate Saudi Arabia from American colonialism. I'm shocked. I'd never heard anybody refer to my country as a colonialist power. So that certainly started me thinking at the time. And of course, now fast forward 30, 40 years, America unfortunately has emerged as the world's greatest power and also the greatest enforcer of its Pax Americana. And it's not always a pleasant thing.
Yeah. You know, I think probably the Vietnam War, even though I was born a couple of years after it, really like a year after it, finally ended. I think it probably has a lot to do with kind of my very formative brainwashing as a young kid against war, because I knew people, you know, friends' parents and that kind of thing. My parents never talked about it all that much. But, you know, I remember one of my friend's moms just so mad about it in 1985 or something, just so upset. And it was a civil war, and it was none of our damn business, and slam her fist down on the counter kind of a thing, because people that she knew and cared about died in that thing. And so she still wasn't over it. And it, you know, hey, you can't really argue with that when they lost anyway. The whole thing was a big for nothing. So, you know, that was kind of, for me, a good example of, you know, or and really nobody disagreed with that, right? Like, that was the consensus, was, man, wish that had never happened when I was a kid, kind of just in the decade after it. It was always okay for me to be anti-war. And also, everybody in my neighborhood was Democrats when Reagan was in power when I was a kid. So that was nice, too, that it was okay for everybody to be anti-government in my formative years. In a democratic kind of a way, you understand, but in opposition to the current regime kind of way, in opposition to warmongering kind of way. But so that's the Vietnam syndrome, right? That's what the first Gulf War, Robert Perry says, had as its number one goal, actually, was winning over the American people to the efficacy of military force, how much fun it can be for us all if we can go and do a war every once in a while.
It's true, Scott, because don't forget, I should have mentioned earlier, we had been through the Korean War, and that ended only a decade before we got deeply involved in Vietnam. And Korean War shocked the hell out of everybody, because here we were, the omnipotent United States that had defeated Nazi Germany and Japan and everything, and yet we were fought to a standstill by North Korean and Chinese infantry with practically no air cover. The thought was wrong. We were the good guys. I mean, we still had this aura of World War II propaganda that infused everything. But it was very hard for Americans, as I recall, to accept that their country was doing something bad, particularly or wrong, particularly since it involved the communists, who were held up as, you know, as today we talk about Islamic terrorists. Well, it was the commies back in those days. And a lot of people believe there were Reds under every bed. Some still do.
Do you think that kind of making up for the stalemate in Korea was part of the motivation behind Vietnam, that this is kind of a do-over? We'll go, you know, if we can't beat the champ, we'll beat the runner-up, try to?
Well, I think so, because in both wars we were fighting the Red Chinese. Communist China was deeply involved in supporting North Vietnam. It sent all its supplies and logistics, weapons, advisors, intelligence information. So we were back fighting the Red Chinese again. It was interesting. The U.S. Air Force used to, quote, stray off course, unquote, and bomb the Chinese railroads leading into North Vietnam pretty regularly. And I remember the Beijing issued the 9,124th serious warning to the United States, cease and desist or else. But it was like a big game, but both sides knew the limits that they could go to.
Yeah, you know, and then it's funny that it was easy enough for Nixon to just go to China, shake hands with Mao Zedong, and then it didn't matter if, in fact, it was in our interest for Vietnam to cozy up to China to whatever degree, because we're turning them capitalist now. Well, fascist, but anyway, end of the mass starvation all the time, that kind of thing, and split them off from the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And so even if the domino theory had been correct, they made it a moot point. They could have just gone and shaken hands with Mao in the first place. You know, Kennedy could have gone taking care of the whole matter in 1961 or whatever. Now, hey, help us negotiate with this Ho Chi Minh guy and keep him on the side of the trade agreement or whatever imperial interest, you know?
I think so, Scott, but I don't think that the Red Chinese were in a mood to talk to us back in 61, but certainly President Nixon, who I've always considered one of our better presidents, seized the initiative and made this momentous decision, which went against everything we believe in. Imagine today President Obama flying and meeting the head of ISIS or Al-Qaeda and sit down and talk to them. It was that big a thing. It was an earth-shaking change. It was certainly the right thing to do. It was another example of the CIA so busy worrying about what to eat for lunch that they missed this huge event of the Russian-Chinese split. That should have been taken advantage of earlier, but Nixon gets kudos for having finally done so.
Yeah. Well, you think LBJ could have done it? Wait a minute. The part about Nixon being great. What about his high treason in 68 where he sent Anna Chenault to screw up the peace deal that LBJ was working on in order to prolong the war and have a talking point that he had a secret plan to end it?
Well, that was Henry Kissinger's influence on him. And Nixon was right in the sense he did not want to go into peace negotiations until he had some kind of leverage and until he felt that the U.S. was at least on top and was not negotiating from defeat. That's my understanding. And that's why Nixon prolonged the war. And, of course, like any good politician, he didn't want to accept the onus of defeat, which was eventually laid at his feet.
Yeah. Well, that was a pretty damn dirty trick to do that when he didn't have any official government authority whatsoever, right? Him and Kissinger were just private citizens at the time, screwing up Johnson's negotiations for their own gain in the campaign. I mean, that's pretty bad.
I think I worked for Nixon as a speechwriter during that period, or maybe it was a few years after. And now, even though he wasn't in the government, he was still very influential.
Yeah, certainly in that case, it seems like. All right, well, listen, thanks very much for coming back on the show, Eric. I appreciate it.
See you for the next war, Scott.
Yeah, we got plenty, so we'll be around. That's the great Eric Margolies, everybody. EricMargolies.com is his website. Spell it like Margolis. EricMargolies.com. And you can find him at UNS Review. That's UNZ, UNS.com. And, yeah, oftentimes at the American Conservative as well. LouRockwell.com as well. And that's it. So see you tomorrow. Thanks.